It's the illustrious from high above Wyoming mainstream media. Joined by Mr. Misdemeanor himself, the Saratoga Sledgehammer. Starting your day the right way on the Independence Network. It's time for the morning show with your hosts, David Iverson and Jailbird Joey.
And it's time once again for the morning show here on the Independence Network. Jailbird Joey in the driver's seat this morning, going to take you through the next hour with my good friend David Iverson beside me up there in Sheridan. Here sounds like you had an interesting event there in Buffalo last night, right, Mr. Iverson?
We did, Joey. First of all, good morning. Welcome everyone to the program. Harriet Hageman was in Buffalo last night, and it was a packed house as usual, and Harriet was her normal enlightening self. Lots of topics for discussion last night, from illegal immigration to natural asset companies, the Rock Springs management plan. Yeah, she talked about a lot of different stuff that we can get to on the program this morning. Again, packed house, and one very surprising thing is I didn't see a single redcoat in the audience. Really, most everybody that attended the event were conservatives. So, I mean, that was a pleasant surprise yesterday evening.
I'd say in any normal given time, in a regular year, that wouldn't be too surprising because it's their norm. They don't care about what's actually good for Wyoming, good for liberty, or good for the people. But it's an election year. Wouldn't you think you'd, what we call free chicken, take that free chicken? We're going to have a bunch of voters who are excited about stuff and maybe will associate me with Harriet Hageman. If I show up and just shake her hand, I'll go to these events. But no, I'm sure that was a little too big a pill for them to swallow.
It was way too big. And one guy who was noticeably absent was Johnson County Chairman Mike Madden. You would think that if you're U.S. Congresswoman is in town, the GOP chairman ought to be there. But, you know, as usual, he was a no-show.
Well, he was probably at home too busy not planning central committee meetings. But anyway, it's surprising to me the way Harriet does it. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise. It's more of a relief. When I was the chairman of the Carbon County Republican Party, I would be driving down the street here past the Civic Center or the Community Center and see that John Barrasso was holding a meeting. And I'm like, you didn't tell us. It's like you avoided us and you just went to your good old boys club, and people that have been here forever set up this meeting. The Republican Party wasn't included. It wasn't advertised. And you're not here that often, not just in Carbon County, but in the state of Wyoming. But Harriet is here so constantly and so well advertised. There really is no excuse other than something that's probably going to make you not look very good for not attending these events if you're in the legislature or a representative within the Republican Party. You know, she has probably reached out to you, at least for advertising assistance. But yeah, she's here so often, that can't be the excuse of, well, she comes all the time, I don't need to go see her every time. You need to do your job.
Exactly right. And, you know, there were a lot of cars from Sheridan. I saw some folks from Gillette that were there. So people from around Northeast Wyoming drove a little bit to come see Harriet. So Mike Madden has no excuse whatsoever.
Well, we'll just see how things turn out. Remember that when we go into this election season, it's not just legislators that are being elected on your primary ballot if you're registered to a political party, not independents. They don't have, well, you don't have a party, so you don't have a central committee. So you wouldn't elect precinct committee men and women. But that's another big deal that we really haven't talked about much and should probably get into as the elections draw near. The primary election is when the parties elect their precinct people, and the precinct people are who elect the county chairman coming next March. So there's another task we're going to throw on everybody's list. Not only stay aware and stay involved, but look around your local area, your neighborhoods. Who do you want representing you in the party who's going to be active and hold leadership accountable to make sure at least the information is getting out and the business is getting done. Last I heard in Johnson County, they don't even do normal business. In fact, aside from the statutorily mandated caucuses and convention, they haven't had a meeting in a year.
No, they haven't. And the only meetings they've had since the primary election 2 years ago was the one that's in statute. So that one was held in March, I believe. And then the other two meetings, one was the county caucuses and the other was the county convention, both of which ended up being kind of a crap show. So really, the GOP in Johnson County is, well, I shouldn't say the GOP is doing nothing. The leadership in Johnson County isn't doing anything. The precinct people are doing something. I mean, they're pretty active, and there were several of those people there last night. One thing that Harriet brought up that I kind of want to talk about a little bit, she spent a good deal of time talking about illegal immigration. She's made several trips to the U.S.'s southern border. And she told a story about meeting a couple farmers right along the border, and that their farms directly abut the international line. And because they're a farm and, you know, they're producing food, they're regulated by the FDA. Well, FDA regulations say that if you have one footprint in your field, that all of the crops in a 5-foot radius of that footprint have to be destroyed. Well, think about it. If you've got a big train of illegal immigrants that are coming across the border and tromping through your field, you go out in the morning to inspect it, and here's this big trail through the center of your, you know, whatever crop you're growing. You have to destroy all of those crops within a 5-foot radius of every footprint. And her point, Harriet's point, was that a lot of farmers along our southern border have just stopped farming because they can't make any money out of it, and they're having to destroy all of their crops. I mean, that's just one little impact of illegal immigration that we're facing right now. Not only is our country being invaded, we're having to destroy our food because of our own laws, because illegal immigration is not controlled. The other thing that she mentioned is that there were spaces along the southern border where Trump's wall, I guess we can call it Trump's wall, was being constructed. And then, of course, on January 20th, all work stopped. So she said it was remarkable how much of the materials were laying there on the ground, rusting, and how many pieces of equipment were there. Because the United States government purchased all of the equipment to construct that wall, and they just left it sit. So we're talking about, you know, excavators that are, you know, $300,000 or more a piece, just left there to rot. And she said it was just like this long string of, you know, equipment with the tires blown out and wires ripped out of the engine, a completely disgraceful waste of taxpayer money. I hadn't heard anything about crops having to be destroyed because of illegal immigration. That was, every day you learn something, and every time you meet with Harriet, you learn two or three things.
I wouldn't doubt it. And it's kind of the Biden administration standard, like we did in Afghanistan. Hey, let's have all this handy dandy equipment and just abandon it to the elements and the enemy. So I'm not surprised there. Maybe it's just an example of, hey, this is what Afghanistan is like, and we have it here at home now. And if that's the case, I'd love to see these principles applied equally. If you have to destroy everything within 5 feet of a footprint of an illegal alien, let's start applying that to Seattle, New York, and Chicago. Hey, you've got illegal aliens here. We need to destroy everything within. We could tear those towns down, cities down to the ground, if we applied that same principle. And I know that sounds kind of joking, but if you tell the story like that and say, hey, if it was equally applied, we wouldn't have any of these metropolises that are sanctuary cities, because we'd have to, by law, rip down everything near these footprints. It might start to make some sense of how we're dealing, or at least the current administration is dealing with all this stuff in an extremely poor and, I don't know, uneconomically viable way, because, you know, those big cities would start to take notice and say, hey, yeah, we don't care because it's one guy on a farm and he's got hundreds of acres. But if you started tearing down my apartment building because there's illegals in here, I might want to get involved and have a problem with that.
Oh, for sure. But Anyway, she spoke for about an hour. I've got the whole thing recorded, and I'm going to publish it on the podcast probably tomorrow. And it's a great discussion, as always. And like I said, she touched on a number of different topics. One more point that she mentioned on illegal immigration. She said that she's visited the border a couple of times, and one of those visits was announced through the media. Hey, Congress is going to the southern border. And she said the interesting thing about that visit is there was no illegal immigration during their visit. Now, how is that possible? She said she walked up to a section of the southern border, and the Border Patrol told her that they've recovered over 200 dead bodies right there along the southern border. And the reason why those bodies were there is if you're an illegal immigrant and you're not going through the cartel, well, they just track you down and kill you and just leave your body lay. Well, when Congress visited, none of that stuff was there. And there were no illegal crossings during their visit. So what this should tell you is that the Biden administration is absolutely able to shut down the southern border. And, you know, there was a phone call made to one or more cartels, you know, ahead of their visit and said, hey, stop this. We don't want to see any illegal immigrants coming across the border. So the Biden administration is absolutely able to stop illegal immigration. If they can do it for a couple of congresspeople, they can do it across the board. And the Biden administration is just not interested in doing that. And then, you know, we know it's a fact that they are flying illegal immigrants into the interior of the United States. Some of those people are ending up in Wyoming. If you've paid attention to any of the news reports coming from Wyoming communities, there are illegal immigrants that are being arrested for a variety of crimes throughout Wyoming. So again, you know, any of this stupid discussion of, oh, it's not happening here, that's total bullcrap. It's happening in every state. Illegal immigration is impacting Wyoming, and it was I don't want to say it was refreshing to hear Harriet say that, but it was more of a confirmation of what we already know that's happening.
Yeah, and I'll just throw one last thing. If you need confirmation because you don't believe Harriet, or there's no, here's a piece of paper that has a picture of the person that got arrested while being an illegal alien, just go to, I think it's Sweetwater Now. They have a daily Sweetwater County arrest report with mugshots and all the details, at least of what they were arrested for. And I'd say a good 20 to 25% of those is NWSC hold for other agency ICE. And that means that they're being held for illegal immigration on top of the crimes they committed. So there's at least a name, a face, and a series of crimes attributed to a person that, hey, I don't trust the media either, but I can always go back and confirm those through court documents. So anyway, speaking of things being able to be confirmed as accurate, we had a article, here we go, yeah, out of the Cowpie, of course, Little Lion Leo Trotsky Wolfson put out a article yesterday titled What a Special Session Could Look Like for Wyoming Legislators. Now, it's funny, we talked about this yesterday. I know you went deep into it on your show, how the Wyoming mainstream lying liberal media doesn't seem to be on the same page yet, even though they all get the same wire and they regurgitate the same stories. You got some of them saying there's no special session, some of them saying leadership doesn't want a special session, and some of them who are finally caught up saying, okay, legislative leadership is flipped, there's a possibility. So we're getting all these conflicting stories. This is why you need to make sure that you're well-informed and know what's going on. Don't just take a headline and run with it, because even the media is in conflict with itself here across the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. But in his article, Trotsky goes into what a special session would look like, and he states, quote, what it won't be is a quick vote to overturn any of Gordon's vetoes. That ship sailed when the 2024 legislative session was officially adjourned. With a special session called Wyoming's legislature, it automatically falls under general session rules, aside from a 20-day limit on how many days it can convene. So yesterday on my show, I got a biological mailbag question from a listener, and it kind of asked this question, and I broke it down. Vetoes can be addressed. There's nothing in the Constitution or in the state law prohibiting the legislature from reconvening and addressing vetoes. There's no timeline like there is on the governor. You must veto within 3 or 15 days. There's also no law saying that once the legislature has adjourned its session, it cannot revisit any of the work. As long as the legislature is still that legislature. Right now we're in the 67th, and in January they will seat the 68th. So the 68th legislature, after the election, can't come back and deal with business of the 67th legislature. It's a different body. But while they're still within their same term, I haven't found anything. And maybe there's some obscure rule in the procedure, the process that they kept talking about, the House rules, the Senate rules. But even in Mason's, there is no limitation on the vetoes. And I did some research last night. There's about 25 states that have specific rules that address how vetoes are handled. And let me see if I can find the term here. Post-adjournment veto bills and laws. And we don't have one in Wyoming restricting the legislature at all. The Article 4, Section 8 of the Wyoming Constitution covers vetoes. And all it really does is say how long the governor has to veto something and what the vote count must be in order to overturn the veto. So I think we're getting some bad or confusing information, or I just haven't been able to find the rule, because I know there's not a law or constitutional provision limiting the legislature from addressing vetoes. What do you think, Dave?
Well, a couple of thoughts. First, if there is no rule or law or whatever preventing the legislature from tackling a veto override within a certain time frame, then there would be nothing to prevent the legislature from, I don't know, going back to, well, we're in a budget session now, so let's, if we're correct on this, it would mean that they could go back to the general session and say, well, the governor vetoed, you know, the 2023 bill, whatever it is, and bring up that veto override. So, I mean, if there's nothing on the books that says they can't do that, there's no reason why they can't. but I don't think that there's, I haven't seen anything in any of the, it's definitely not in the Constitution. I haven't seen it in the Manual of Legislative Procedure or in their joint rules, though I haven't, you know, gone through it page by page. But if you notice, in none of these articles, Trotsky's, for example, he doesn't cite a specific rule. Of course, he hardly ever cites anything anyway, so that's not even really unique. But there's no reference as to why it's this way. Really, I think that Trotsky is just going off of what Albert Ogden conservatives have said, that they're going to do it by the general session rules and we can't go back. Well, I don't see why there's, you know, maybe they're talking about precedence, but as far as I know, that could be the only thing that they're referencing. And so I really don't think that anybody in the media has a good handle on what's going on. And they've already proven that they're just going to listen to whatever Albert and Ogden say and run with it. And, you know, as we all know, Albert and Ogden do not make up the sum total of the Wyoming legislature. So there's no reason why we should just pay attention to them and do whatever they say. But there was a lot of other interesting things in Trotsky's article about how the session might run. And I think you had a couple of points you wanted to bring up.
Well, that was the first one, and I do agree with you. And I love how something organically brings up another one of our standards here at the Independence Network of, we ask you to not even take our word for it. We're sitting here every morning for hours, putting together information, putting it out to you people, and we beg you to do your research. And, you know, as far as the legislature and the governor is concerned, you're just the people. You don't matter that much, but you matter to us. Trotsky and Albert and Ogden and even the governor just want you to take their word for it. And in Trotsky's case, he wants you to do that twice removed. Well, yeah, I know I'm right because Ogden Driscoll told me this. People, do your homework, please. First start by double checking us and then apply that same thing to your legislators and other journalists. But I digress. The thing keeps coming up, and I believe John Bear said it, about if we go in there and we suspend the rules, which makes me assume there's some rule, or at least, like you said, precedence, which is considered an unwritten rule of the legislature. for them to consider the vetoes. As long as they suspend the rules, that they could go ahead and knock it out in a day. I believe he says, oh, here we go. Six bills that I am interested in. Nothing could likely be done to prevent amendments, but Bears said a gentleman's agreement could be arranged to keep bills in their original form. I think in this case, it sounds like John Bear is specifically talking about only addressing vetoes, which, okay, line item vetoes plus bill vetoes, that equals about six. A suspension of the rules could allow for a fast track to quickly move bills through the legislative process without the assembling of committees and multiple readings. Bear said that in 1981, the legislature convened for 2 days and during that time considered 30 bills, including a budget. Quote, we consider hundreds of bills in several weeks. I think we can do six. Now, couple things with that. I don't know what this rule is that they're talking about. I don't know how they're approaching it, but there's proponents on the other side, Dan Dockstetter, Clark Stith, I believe Albert Summers, and even Ogden Driscoll, who stated recently he's still leaning towards no special session, but he may not have a choice, that they would do it only if it was limited to House or Senate File 54, the tax relief program. John Bear here says a gentleman's agreement could be arranged to keep bills in their original form. Everybody has to understand, especially the legislators, that you can feel that way. You can make those quotes. You can hope and wish and dream. But until you call the special session and sit down and set the rules, everything's on the table.
So a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, if you suspend the rules, and this is not just dealing with our legislature, but any deliberative body, whether it's city council, county commissioners, your board of the dump, like I used to be on, if you suspend the rules, the body can do pretty much whatever they want. I mean, that's kind of implied when you say we're going to suspend the rules. But, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Joey, but when you make the motion to suspend the rules, it has to be to do a specific action. Or am I wrong about that?
You have to vote to suspend the rules and then cite the specific rule you're suspending. Because if a blanket motion to suspend the rules is adopted, then all of a sudden the Speaker of the House isn't the Speaker of the House. Right. You can literally do whatever you want because you've just suspended all of the rules.
Right.
I don't think you have to limit it to a topic, but you do have to limit it to a rule. So if that suspension of the rules could apply to two or three different bills, you would suspend the specific rule, not just we want to suspend the rules so we can do this on this bill.
Okay. So that helps me out. So you could suspend the rules to do anything that you want, even though, like Joey said, you would need to say, I'm going to suspend this particular rule to do this. If they have the votes, they can do whatever they want. But secondly, if it's the rules of the general session, as Trotsky says, then, you know, bills have to follow the normal procedure. That is, get introduced, assigned to a committee, the committee goes through it, refers it back to the body debates it, votes on it. Three times, then it goes to the other chamber. So if it's general session rules, the bill has to go through, you know, the normal process. But you can fast track a bill. They did that a couple of times in the budget session to where they want to, what do they call it? They call it accelerating the bill. So instead of doing three readings on three separate days, they could do two readings on one day. So first point, if you're going to suspend the rules, you can do whatever you want as long as you have the votes to do it. Second, if it's going to follow general session rules, then it has to go through the whole process. But third, I have kind of a disagreement with Representative Bear, and I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. If you're going to say, we're going to ram this bill through on one day, well, that limits debate of the bill. And as we all know, redcoats are notorious for trying to short circuit bills, insert poison pills. And I mean, they're like, think about any devious thing that could be done with a piece of legislation, the redcoats will do it. So when you limit the amount of debate on a bill, you also limit the amount of time that you can discover, you know, any sort of poison pill or anything they've done to it. And so this whole, you know, gentleman's agreement to keep the bills as they are, I think that's really dangerous. What do you think, Joey?
Absolutely. I think it really is, because, again, everything's on the table. Let's go back to process and procedure. Again, I don't see anywhere in black and white. Yeah, I'm sorry, triggered you a little there, but this is what we do, bud. That word's going to come up again. There's nowhere in black and white that I can find that says you cannot reconvene to deal with vetoes. Now, if they're just going to deal with the vetoes, then they don't need to worry about the rest of the stuff, because the only thing you can address in a veto is the veto. There's no amendments. It's not germane to discuss the content of the bill, and they give them a little bit of leeway on that, but it's no. The question on the floor is, do we override the governor's veto? Not what are the merits of the bill. The bill's already passed both of these chambers. Now, it would follow the same process as a regular bill. It has to pass by 2/3 in each house, and since there's no amendments allowed to a veto override, concurrence is normally pretty easy. But what John Bear's talking about here is we hope to keep these bills intact, which means it seems like he's acquiescing to the fact that they can't override the veto in that procedure. And we would have to reintroduce the bills as they passed out of the houses as brand new bills. Well, there's a problem with that too. If they call a special session and it's determined that they can't address the vetoes in the veto override process, but they can accelerate a vetoed bill being introduced as a new bill, even if they agree and everybody honors it and they don't change the bill, they just accept the bill as it passed out of the chamber while they were in session, it's a new bill. It still goes to the governor, and he can still veto it again if the legislature doesn't stay in session and shorten that timeline to 3 days and then stick around long enough to have work to address any of these bills that he would technically re-veto. So this is why I'm leaning towards the fight isn't just to get into special session. The fight has got to be go into special session and prove that you have the authority or the ability to address vetoes. Because once you bring it as a new bill, like John Bear says here, oh, we will agree, even if they honor that agreement and they keep those bills intact and repass them as they were in session, we're back to the same point we're at last week. The governor just vetoes it and the legislature's already gone. So we're looking at least, I don't know, 10 days, 3 days of which the legislature will just be sitting around waiting for the governor to get back to them, because he still has veto authority on new bills, which these would be if it's not a veto override.
Yeah, I guess we need to find out, if addressing a veto is appropriate in a special session, which, like we said, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. It's just a motion. It's a motion just like any other. You know, you can make a motion for anything you want on the floor. So I don't see any reason why they couldn't move to override the governor's veto on House Bill 125. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be well within the rules.
Or within the rules, because there is no rule. I mean, unless they can point me to the specific, I don't know, word they're looking at in Mason's or the House rules, I know for a fact it's not in the green books, it's not in state law, and it's not in the Constitution. So I get it. They have to operate on their own rules and they have their own rules written, but you know me, I do okay research, not as good as you. I'm not an investigative journalist or anything. But I've looked through everything I can get my hands on, and I'm not seeing anything in black and white saying when the governor vetoes a bill and the legislator has adjourned, this can, this can't, this must, these are the timelines. There's nothing in black and white. There's nothing even mentioning that there's a consideration or a provision for it. So it has to be some obscure, probably, like you said, a precedent. Oh, we've never done this. But John Bear points out that they have done things like this in the past, and I think the LSO even chimed in saying there's only been X amount of special sessions in the history of Wyoming, but never one that was called specifically to address veto items. So even the LSO seems to be on board with the focus of the special session would likely to be addressing vetoes, and they don't come out and say that there's any procedure or rule prohibiting that. So I don't know, but everybody I hear, they're arguing a different point. It's amazing that nobody seems to know what's going on, but they're all the ones that make the decisions. And the one thing we haven't talked about is the straw man argument that we keep hearing. Anybody who doesn't have a point always says it would be too costly to the taxpayer to get together and have a special session. We're talking about $35,000 a day. That is one of the reasons why Representative Mike Yen of Jackson says he opposes a special session. Mike Yen doesn't have a problem with spending, wasting, or throwing away the people's money. And at least in this case, if we don't get positive resolution on these bills that we're trying to make sure are shepherded through because it was the will of the people and the majority of the legislature that passed resoundingly most of these bills, we at least get the voting record. And I'll pay $350,000 collectively as a state of Wyoming to find out who's screwing the pooch on gun rights and, you know, stopping the murder of babies. Not a problem.
Right. Well, there's, like you say, Mike Yen has never been opposed to spending taxpayer money. And the only reason that Yen doesn't want a special session is he knows that probably House Bill 148 is going to come up and House Bill 125 is going to come up. So there, you know, he doesn't want those bills to see the light of day anymore. Mike Yen may be a lot of things, but at least he's the Democrat's Democrat. So, you know, he's definitely opposed to getting rid of any sort of gun control laws, and he really doesn't want any more restrictions on abortion. So I think that Mike Yen's objection, while he frames it in terms of the process, I think it has more to do with the substance of what would come up during that special session than anything.
Yeah, and we have proof of that, examples of that. When they tried to revive 125 in the Senate, bring it back from the committee that killed it, the argument from a lot of people was, I'm just not in favor of the process of overruling the chair. I still like the bill. And when they finally, you know, clutched it from the jaws of defeat and brought it back to the floor in the Senate, it passed resoundingly and went back to the House and passed resoundingly. But you heard that argument. I'm not against the bill. I'm against this procedure. And so, hey, thanks for sharing your feelings. I wish you the best of luck with those. Do your job. Fight for the principles that you say you support, whether you're up for re-election or not. Do the right thing all the time and be willing to be held accountable for your actions. Isn't that one of the cowboy ethics? Be proud of your work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. So I just pulled up the Manual of Legislative Procedure, and I'm just trying to go through this a little bit while we're talking. So let's talk about that loony leftist lawyer from Laramie, and I'll try to go through this during the discussion. But he's back, and he's decided that he's going to give up on removing Trump from the ballot. Of course, the Wyoming Supreme Court dismissed that case on his request, by the way. Well, now he's decided that he's going to try to remove Chuck Gray from the ballot using the same, I would say argument, but it really wasn't an argument because it's so absurd. But he's saying, according to the 14th Amendment, Section 3, that he's going to try to remove Chuck Gray from the ballot. And his argument being that Chuck Gray engaged in an insurrection. Well, I'm pretty sure that our Secretary of State was not in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, or at least he wasn't at the Capitol riot. I don't see any reason why we could remove him from the ballot. But nonetheless, he's filed a lawsuit personally against Chuck Gray. So this has a number of implications. One, that our Secretary of State has to defend against a lawsuit. Second, the state of Wyoming has to spend money defending the Secretary of State. And I'm not exactly sure how that whole thing will work. But let's not forget his first petition to the court. It was full of links to YouTube videos and questionable logic. The guy really is a Looney Tune, and he most definitely is a leftist. And I think this is just another example of trying to use the law to achieve a political end. What say you, Joey?
Well, I got to say, I was not terribly surprised at the United States Supreme Court decision on the Colorado case that ultimately doomed this idiot's piece of paper from being heard. But remember the series of events that happened. He filed in the lower court. The lower court said, no, you're crazy. He refiled with the state Supreme Court. I don't know why he was hoping for better. But when the U.S. Supreme Court made their decision, what I was surprised about, it was unanimous. But that's fine. They were just looking at the law and applying it as it was written. Not a problem there at all. He didn't withdraw his case immediately. And when the Wyoming Supreme Court finally dismissed his case, it was the greatest dismissal letter in the world. It was one sentence. We hereby rid ourselves of the burden of your garbage, basically was the whole thing. So you would think, and I was hoping that, okay, that was a good story. That was fun to go through. Unfortunately, it did cost, you know, the state and the taxpayers some time and money, but it's done. No problem. Forget about this guy. But, you know, here he is again. And my question is, has anybody thought to maybe unplug this guy for 3 to 5 seconds, plug him back in, see if he resets? The insanity continues. So once again, he does cite the 14th Amendment, the third provision, which specifically says no person shall be senator, representative of Congress, blah, blah, blah. Basically, you can't hold office or as an officer or a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state. That's where it applies to Chuck Gray in the Constitution. Shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, which if Chuck Gray is an officer of the state, I don't think he had an opportunity to engage in rebellion or insurrection against the state of Wyoming. He obviously, like you said, wasn't there on January 6th. But I think this next portion is what the goofball out there in Laramie is driving towards, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. And I believe that in being an election denier is what they call it, and by being endorsed by Trump, by filing that amicus brief and all the things that Chuck Gray has engaged in to make sure our Constitution is enforced the way it's written, that our elections are not interfered with, he's accusing Chuck Gray of giving aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States. I don't think that's going anywhere. But so unfortunately, and this is a perfect example of what I'm always saying, any jackass with a signature and $25 can sue you for everything. We've seen it in the Wyoming Republican Party. We've seen it across politics throughout Wyoming. So this is not one of those things people can dismiss and say, it never happens. It doesn't happen here in Wyoming. And it's okay because it always gets defeated. The cost of it being defeated and the Constitution being, I don't know, interpreted the way it's written is the point of this lawfare. It's to drain the resources and energy of your opposition because you can't win legitimately.
Exactly right. And what's going through my head is, so this guy is arguing that Chuck Gray is an accessory to insurrection after the fact. So the insurrection's already happened, and because Chuck Gray is, you know, doing everything he can to defend the former president, that he's somehow associated with an insurrection that happened 2,000 miles away. Wow, man. This guy, like you said, somebody needs to unplug him and plug him back in. Maybe we'll get a reset.
And again, if you're going to go and use the words insurrection or rebellion, which are the only words you can use when you're citing the 14th Amendment, why has no one been charged with insurrection or rebellion? There's been a lot of trespassing. There's been a lot of vandalism charges. There's been a lot of different charges. Nothing that raises to the point or includes the words in the charges, insurrection or rebellion. So how you can do that without anybody who was actually there being charged with it, and then, I don't know, I guess this would be an ex post facto because Chuck would have had to support it later after it happened. It's like, you know, saying, I want you to go in jail because you put a thumbs up on a Facebook page that was related to this thing that we still haven't proven actually happened. This is why we call him the Looney Tunes lawyer. It's insanity, and it has no basis in fact or law.
So I'm looking through, back to our previous discussion, I've pretty much looked through all of the references to a veto in the Manual of Legislative Procedures. And really, the only thing that it says time-wise about a veto is if the legislature has not adjourned, sign and die, then the chief clerk will be available to receive the veto. Otherwise, and it's in a couple of different passages, otherwise it says the veto will be delivered to the Secretary of State. But it doesn't say anything about, you know, how long you have to override a veto, if it has to be in that same session. It doesn't say anything like that. And again, I'm just kind of like scanning through here, but I don't see any time limits or anything except for the reference to the chief clerk. So maybe that's what they're talking about.
Well, you know, that goes back to the Wyoming Constitution. Under approval or veto of legislation by governor, the regular, you know, hey, the governor can veto these bills. It takes a two-thirds majority to override the veto. If any bill is not returned by the governor within 3 days while the legislature is in session, Sunday's accepted. After its presentation to him, the same shall be law unless the legislature by its adjournment prevent its return, in which case it shall be law unless he shall file the same with his objections in the office of the Secretary of State within 15 days after such adjournment. So the only timelines and restrictions I'm seeing are on the governor. And it just says, hey, when the legislature's not here anymore, you have to send your veto message to the Secretary of State, but now you have 15 days to do it. Again, there's nothing anywhere that says hard and fast they can't come back and deal with it. But on the other hand, I'm going to stick to this point. If they do come back to deal with it and decide we still can't address vetoes, these have to be new bills, that special session, give it an extra 3 to 5 days in your assumed how long it's going to be calculations. Because if they go in there and they pass these laws again and send them to the governor's office and then go home,
the timeline resets.
They've
itself.
Literally wasted, they've wasted the time, because even if the governor has 3 days, let's just say he doesn't have 15 days, it doesn't matter because they're not there to respond to it. If they stay there, he has to do it in 3 days, and they've given themselves a calendar space in order to respond to future vetoes. So I don't understand why they wouldn't just address the vetoes, since we pretty much can't find any rules saying they can't. But given the nature of the legislature and how they hem and haw, what did Dave Kinski call it? The legislature, according to Hoyle, with your pinkies, the genteel nature of
The legislature.
Tradition and precedent.
I love that soundbite, man. You know, with your drinking your tea with your pinky extended. But I mean, that's honestly, that's how a lot of our legislature works. I don't know how many times I would send you a message, Joey, and say, well, they just found another obscure rule, or they can do something that nobody else knew that they could do. And that's what they said over and over. Well, we found this obscure rule, and it allows us to do, and magically, the obscure rule that they found each and every time allowed them to do exactly what they wanted to do. So, a lot of this is kind of up in the air. It may be related to precedent, which precedent can be overturned. That happens all the time in our system. So, honestly, there's nothing in the rules. There's nothing in the Manual of Legislative Procedure that I can find. So I'm with you, Joey. I don't see any reason why they couldn't just say, I move to override the governor's veto on House Bill 125. Boom. Done.
Yeah, the only thing that would prevent that from happening was the messages would have to be read into the chamber. And I don't see why they wouldn't. If they reestablished the legislature in a special session, the first thing they should do after the rules are set is read in all the messages that have come in since they adjourned. So it should already be on the table. In this case, again, I don't know, because those messages go to the Secretary of State's office. All I know is there is nothing in black and white in their procedures, in the law or the Constitution, preventing it. So I really think that should be the focus, especially for these conservatives that are going the alternate route of still attempting to push the call for a special session themselves by a 35% majority of both chambers. And remember, there's other ways of doing it. Ogden and Albert can call one. The governor can call a special session. There's a lot of different ways. And right now, I guess legislative leadership is still thinking about calling a special session, but that doesn't preclude the conservative effort of getting signatures and saying, no, we're going to force you to call a special session. And in that situation, I wouldn't offer any quarter on rules or restrictions being assumed. Either prove it or get out of my way. And at least in the Senate, we now have the precedent of overruling the chair when they object. So hopefully some of that backbone is still there in the legislature, and a little bit of it kicks over to the House, and they just get some of this work done.
Well, Joey, did you see that the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed yesterday?
It didn't collapse. It was torn down after being struck by a big old tanker ship. And I've got a problem with this. And this goes back to words mean things. Everyone says it collapsed. In my mind, if it's going to collapse, it's because it fell down on its own. Now, I can't say, and I don't have any actual evidence saying that this was a terroristic attack, but it's interesting to me that the day before this happened, we got a heads up from the FBI that our infrastructure may be under imminent threat of attack. And then all of a sudden, this tanker ship goes haywire and knocks off the bridge that is one of the main access routes from Maryland back into Washington, D.C. So I'm not going to stand on it's a bridge collapse, it's an infrastructure problem. I think there's a little more to this than just, oopsie, London Bridge fell down.
Well, I mean, obviously it was struck by that tanker. And, you know, I didn't see it happen in real time, but I was just watching the replay. You can see the tanker, you know, lights go out, lights come back on, boom, strikes the pier, and the whole bridge comes down. What I was more interested in, though, is Joe Biden saying that the federal government is going to pay for the reconstruction of the bridge. How is that the federal government's problem?
Well, on its face and initially, it's not. Now, if it's determined to be an act of terrorism, then yeah, you can pull funds from multiple sources within the federal government to say, this is recovery efforts for an act of terrorism. And let's go back to what you were saying about when you watch the replay on the video.
Yeah.
The lights go out, the boat drifts, the lights come back on, it changes direction. There's a big plume of black smoke coming out of the back of the boat at that point. The lights go out again. It's headed straight, you know, when it readjusted its trajectory, when the lights came back on, it starts heading for the bridge instead of out into the channel, and then drifts a little more. The lights come back on a third time just as it's hitting the pier. The power going on and off, the direction of the boat being redirected, and then I'm guessing the big plume of smoke was from the engines being over-revved. Sounds like things that would happen in a scuffle over control of that boat.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
Somebody's trying to be, I'm the captain now. And what does the captain do? Hit the power button. Turn everything off. We're not doing anything till we figure this out. Scuffle, scuffle, scuffle. Terrorists or pirates or whatever take over the boat. Turn the power back on. Readjust. The crew fights back. Power goes off again. Terrorists get it back. Turn it on. Gun the engine. Big black plume of smoke. I'm not saying this is what happened. I'm saying that from what I'm seeing, it's not as simple as the bridge fell down and the federal government should just pay to fix it. If the federal government wants to pay to fix it, we need to know exactly what happened on that boat.
Fair enough. Where I was going with that is, first, I haven't shined up my tinfoil hat this morning. So, you know, I hadn't really even considered any of the perhaps conspiratorial implications of this. But I was more interested in why should taxpayers foot the bill for something that happened in a state? And I mean, I understand that we have disaster relief, you know, after a tornado goes through or a hurricane, the federal government typically offers probably a wrong word to use there. But anyway, the government says, well, we're going to, you know, provide however many dollars in disaster relief. But really, when something happens in your state, it's the state's responsibility. I'm assuming that the Francis Scott Key Bridge was property of the state of Maryland. I don't see any reason why the federal government needs to be involved. But we seem to be living in this space where the federal government is involved in everything. That it doesn't matter what happens. You know, the federal government, here I come to save the day, and they show up and pull out the taxpayer's checkbook. Well, our system was never set up that way. If something goes wrong in a state, That's the state's responsibility. But we've ceded, you know, a lot of our authority to the federal government, and a lot of it comes in the form of relief, disaster relief, or what have you, when really it's the responsibility of the state. And I think this goes a lot farther in that, you know, we all know that if federal dollars arrive, our legislators will do handsprings to get their hands on it. And, you know, I just, again, one of the things that went through my head was, I don't think this is the federal government's responsibility. I understand that it impacts commerce a great deal. The Francis Scott Key Bridge was a major artery for, you know, trucking and trade. I get all of that. But still, nobody's explained to me why taxpayers in Wyoming need to pay for a bridge that collapsed in Maryland.
Yeah, and I just pulled up the map to double check. And this may be their reasoning. I still don't know if it justifies it, at least not well enough in our minds that, hey, this should be 100% federal government. But the Francis Scott Key Bridge is on the federal Interstate 695. So as a part of the federal interstate, okay, that may be a portion of it. But it's also Maryland State Route 70, you know, shared. I-80 is also Wyoming Highway 30. So there's shared responsibility there. So again, I don't know that it should be 100% federal taxpayer money going to resurrecting this bridge. But I can see how, you know, they'll find every little possible, oh, well, we'll do it this way because, hey, we're the government. We're here to help. That's the thing Reagan warned us about. And that seems to be the posture. First, they'll say, no, we got to do something. And then they find out how to justify it later, as opposed to, no, this is the procedure because this is, you know, our law and our structure of government. And we'll offer to help when the process itself demands, hey, this is where you jump in. But I think it could be because, you know, it is on 695. But the idea, and this is something that we really need to keep fighting against, is automatically assuming that when there's a problem, the government is the first, best, and immediate answer. Even if a legitimately down the line, they say, okay, because it's part of the internet or the interstate highway system, it's a federal responsibility, we will assist. Right now, that's not where they're at. Right now, they're like, I'm Uncle Joe, and I've got my money available for you, and we're going to go ahead and take care of it. And that is continuing to feed into the entitlement of the American citizen, always assuming the government's going to come through with a program and some money to fix all your problems. And that is the posture we have to avoid. Whether they end up helping in the future or not, that's different. But to assume up front that that's going to happen, or that you can sell the people on this is how we do it, it's absolutely wrong, and it's one of the things that's crippling America.
And no doubt, you know, that bridge going down, however it, you know, whatever the cause was, is going to have an effect on, you know, shipping countrywide. I mean, the port in Baltimore, I think I saw somewhere where it's the largest port, if not the largest port in the world, one of the largest ports in the world. So there's a lot of stuff that comes through that port, everything from Amazon purchases to food. One of the giant sugar plants is right there in Baltimore. So, you know, you're going to see increase in prices across the board. You know, just about everything we eat or everything we buy from the store has sugar in it. So that's going to have an impact. So I could see how you could make an argument to say, well, this bridge going down is going to have an impact on commerce nationwide, and so it's a national problem. I could see that argument, but I'm still siding with the whole, that's Maryland's problem, not Wyoming's problem.
Yeah, and they would be wrong in making that argument because I'm semi-familiar with the area because of my time in the military, did a lot of training on the East Coast. The Port of Baltimore at Sparrows Point is to the east of the bridge. And if you watch that video, you'll notice that boat, that major shipping vessel, was way too big to go under the bridge had it not hit one of the pillars of the bridge. Everything off to the west of that bridge, it's not major shipping. In fact, the bridges were designed to keep and limit the size of a boat that could go under them and further down into the bay. All the shipping is going to happen on the Atlantic Ocean side, where the Sparrows Point, Baltimore Port is. So a lot of that over the water shipping won't really be affected. You can still get things in and out of the port of Baltimore and then truck them. You just can't truck them across the bridge that doesn't exist. But just a couple miles off to the west, there are other bridges on, you know, I-95. You just alternate routes. It happens. But I think the argument that it's really going to have a legitimate impact on nationwide shipping because it's the port of Baltimore, the port is off to the safe side where they don't have to cross over the bridge wreckage. And the bridge actually was low enough to prevent shipping vessels of that size to go under it anyway. So I think that's another pointless argument that they're going to try to sell to the American people, thinking they're not going to look up a map or shipping routes and say, yeah, but it never happened before. Nobody ever had to do major shipping to the west where this bridge has now fallen.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a big mess. And, you know, they still haven't recovered, as far as I know, that many survivors. I know when I was watching the news yesterday, they had recovered two survivors. But there had to be a ton of cars on the bridge at that time. And from what I understand, they really haven't recovered hardly anybody off of the ship. So that's another question. Hopefully they're able to recover some of the people that, you know, went over into the sea when that happened. But I don't know, horrible thing. And, you know, it's something we got to continue to pay attention to.
Yeah. And it's the reaction that we're going to have to really pay attention to, because once you get through the emergency procedures, which I think in the next couple of days, they're going to stop looking for survivors. There's probably nobody surviving in their car underwater for 4 or 5 days.
Probably not.
But at that point, because it is a bridge and it is on a interstate route, what did President Biden call the Secretary of Transportation? Secretary Booty Juice?
Pete Buttigieg. Something like that.
Pete Buttigieg is in charge of almost all of this, unless the state of Maryland takes full responsibility for the recovery of the bridge and the rebuilding of the bridge. And then at that case, we don't have a point. But as long as the federal government is involved, Pete Buttigieg is driving that bus, and we're going to see more ridiculous garbage. And I'm going to guess under him, it'll take 8 to 10 years to get any type of replacement in place, regardless of the cost. And hopefully by November, they'll be on their way out so we can get that done quicker, even if it is just the state of Maryland addressing it.
Well, Joey, I know that you're very disappointed that Secretary Buttigieg isn't going to be visiting Wyoming now. He's got to go deal with the bridge in Baltimore, so he's not able to come hang out here. I know you're really disappointed about that, and I'm truly sorry for your luck on that one, bud.
Yeah, well, you know, you take it as it comes and you deal with the reality of life, and I really believe I'm going to find a way to survive this one. It might take a little, you know, meditation. It might take a little grain alcohol, but I'm just going to, you know, suck it up and deal with it the Wyoming way.
So what do we got coming up on for the rest of the week, Joey?
Well, we are getting comfortable with our new schedule. I believe today we're going to have some Crosstalk Live and some of the best of the Wide Right Turn series. Let's see, Hair Affair with Christine. She had a new Stylist Sunday come out. We've got that in the list. And I guess we should continue to inform people. In our daily schedule, we replay it again at 3, but we start with the morning show, which you're listening to right now. Then we move on to the 250,000 solidified downloads of Cowboy State Politics. Right after that, about 11 a.m., you'll be able to hear Just Blame Joey Live. And I don't even know what happens after that. We'll jump either into a Crosstalk Live or, I don't know, there's a couple other things. But at the end of the schedule for the morning run, right about 1, 2 o'clock, you'll have what's called the morning show Yesterday Today. So if you miss a show or you want to get caught up, it's great to listen. I've gotten a lot of feedback. I love listening to yesterday's show right before today's show at the midday break. So you can check out the schedule at www.independencenetwork.us. Just click on the schedule tab. It'll show you what's coming up for today, what's coming up for tomorrow. We're running into a little standard over at Just Blame Joey Live, where your new episode of Wide Right Turn will be playing Monday and Friday in the 11 o'clock hour. And then later in the day on Tuesday and Thursday, you'll get an old best of episode. But I would say get familiar and comfortable with that schedule tab, because we do have new content, new shows, new things coming up all the time. And God only knows, between special session and the upcoming elections, we may be on the road at the drop of a hat to go to an event or a deal with a situation. And so anytime you want to know what's happening on the Independence Network, go to the website, check out the schedule tab, and it will be updated, because that updates directly from our programming and broadcasting schedule. And we don't even have to update it. As soon as we change something, that schedule on the website automatically changes. So it is always up to date.
Well, make sure that you don't miss a moment of the Independence Network, and we'll see you tomorrow.